We're back. It's been a little while. Welcome to a podcast hosted by me, James Jones, on August 17th, 2017. This podcast is also known as Radio Free Nintendo. It is the podcast, people. And I say that because Mr. John Lindemann is out today, not joining us for episode 535. And just I'm putting all the proper nouns out there so nobody can make any jokes about it when I introduce Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
James, it's a pleasure to be here. I can say that word for word because John is not here, so I'm going to use the opportunity.
Well, you know, John would have been here, but he had other plans that he felt it was appropriate to notify us of, which I appreciate. I might have appreciated more notice than effectively none, but, you know, we get by, and we get by with some help from our friends like Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone. If I seem subdued in this episode, it's because I did watch a half of preseason football before like, this. So, yeah, if I seem like Miyazaki after you've seen that AI animation demonstration, that's why.
It's basically just injecting pure tryptophan into your bloodstream. And here, in lieu of our bald senior friend, it's Mr. Ed McNulty.
I'm here for my listener call-in for Super Mario Sunshine's Retroactive.
You're a week early. And technically speaking, we haven't officially announced it, but I guess unless I get protestations from the assembled group.
None from me.
We're going to go ahead and record our Retroactive for Super Mario Galaxy next week.
Super Mario Galaxy.
Yeah, we changed games. It was Freudian, too fucking terrible.
Freudian slip.
We want it out. No, for Super Mario Sunshine next week, if you are listening in sometime that's not immediately while we're recording this, which is likely because the audio is not out, that would be August 24th. We will be recording it at 9 p.m. Eastern time. What's that mean? Well, that means it's live, which means you can join us. You can use the Nintendo World Report Discord to chat with us. We will be in there and we will be taking calls because this is all we're going to be talking about for this episode. 2 hours of Super Mario Sunshine conversation.
You're the one that played it for 5 hours straight for some damn reason. I mean,
and I played it for 4 hours straight before that. So yes,
I've done my homework. I've seen the credits and everything, but I did it piecemeal. I don't know what that was about.
So what Greg is alluding to is I streamed the entire game. So I didn't play a single minute of it not streamed, except for when the stream hardware decided to stop because it had had enough. But yeah, I finished the game in this like 5 hour marathon of 20 plus shines and Bowser.
And
the canoe.
I couldn't believe what was going on. I mean, obviously, so I couldn't see every minute of it, but I was pretty much checking in throughout the whole span, and it just kept going. And then even after the credits, he starts loading up the pachinko level. I mean, it's just invent a safe word and say it on the spot.
I wanted to see the pachinko level because it had been 15 years, and I saw it, and I remembered.
This is how you treat your exes?
No, they get better than this. That's a miserable, miserable, miserable pachinko level. But yeah, we'll be doing this one live. We'll take some call-ins. We'll talk some game. John may have 14 shines by the time we roll around to this episode.
That's assuming he plays more than he has already.
Well, 10 would assume he has more than he has already.
Optimistic from what I
know. That was my favorite.
I'm holding out some hope. Yeah, so he's only about 53 shines away from being able to beat the game, so I'm sure he'll get there in time. But that's not this week. In fact, I have a whole week to forget Super Mario Sunshine and start remembering Super Mario Galaxy so we can do our retroactive on that.
Do we drink to forget, James?
No, we didn't have to. It's kind of like when your body rejects an organ. Like, it's that. My body is rejecting the memories of Super Mario Sunshine. So, we're going to go ahead and talk about new business this week, because that's what this week is about, because we didn't have an episode last week, and presumably, we've played video games in that time frame. Pardon my incredulousness, because I have the list in front of me, and, yeah, we kind of play video games. But Seren is the guest, and as the person who has, I mean, I guess, effectively the newest stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Some of the stuff, some of this hot unavailable video games. Why don't you go ahead and start us off?
Sure. So my name is James Jones, and I'm here to talk to you about the new Layton and the new Ace Attorney.
You know, I would love to talk to people about the new Ace Attorney game, but Capcom won't let me.
So 2-3 days ago, at the time of recording, was the release of Agents of Mayhem, the new game by the Saints Row team, and I slogged 35 hours into that thing, and that game's mediocre as all hell. So I played the new Layton game. Layton's Mystery Journey, Catch Riel and the Millionaire's Conspiracy? Question
that
mark?
Feels, sure. That feels, yeah. That feels like either
apparently
one...
Apparently it's impossible for someone to say that title, even if correctly, without being kind of incredulous to
they
it.
They changed the title like 3 months before it shipped.
Yeah.
So, remember those Agatha Christie DS games?
Nope. We drink to forget, James.
Agatha Christie, the ABC murders. Like, it's less horrific title than that. This feels like the Fire Emblem Fates Shadows of Valentia game of the Layton franchise. Like, I don't just keep fucking throwing suffixes on so people don't realize people know for sure this isn't about Mr. Layton.
So yeah. So yeah, you don't play as Layton. You play as non-deadbeat child. You're not playing as Herschel Layton. He has two children, and you're playing as the one that isn't a deadbeat. Now, both of them have gotten mobile games. There was Alfendi Layton, who's a detective, and we don't talk about him anymore. And we have Catch Riel Layton, who is now the star of her own game. This game has puzzles. This game is running in the Layton 5 and 6 engine to the point where when you play on your phone, it splits into a top screen and a bottom screen, and you stroke your thumb along the bottom screen to move a magnifying glass along the top half of your phone.
That sounds miserable.
You can tap on the top, but the benefit of doing that is that the magnifying glass lights up when you're over interactive objects, so you're not pixel hunting at that point.
Right. But I kind of like that, though, because it allows you to hold your phone more comfortably.
Oh, absolutely. So yeah, I will, to preface, so this game is on iPhone, Android, and Nintendo 3DS in Japan, and it was just announced today that it's coming to 3DS in the West in October. Yep. And this game is, I believe, $16 on iOS and Android in the West, and 40 on 3DS. And it's the exact same game. The difference is you have, I think, 10 more puzzles on the 3DS version and some of the DLC costumes. Because there's like $22 of DLC costumes for this game. That's like 7 costumes. Each costume is like $4.
Well, That's how they
change the prices around. It's like, well, technically you're getting $40 of content on the 3DS version because you're getting 7 extremely expensive costumes.
Mm. Level 5 is a nightmare.
It would be worth it if you could wear them all at the same time.
Also, the game has no 3D on the 3DS, just a heads up.
Which is weird because it's using the same engine.
Yep. Also, the game was made in HD and downscaled to 240p for the 3DS version. Mm. So the 3DS version is more than twice the price and is inferior in almost every way. Just to put that out there for people. So, yeah, this game, boy, I had read in an interview that part of the reason why you're not playing as Herschel Layton is because they wanted to start with a bunch of small-scale mysteries, and after Layton saved the world 6 times, it doesn't make sense for him to be trying to find someone's cat.
I mean, does that really make not make sense for him? Because he does fucking shit that makes no sense all the time.
Mm-hmm. But they were not fucking kidding. So this game is, for the most part, there's a through line, but for the most part, it's individual chapters with individual mysteries, and each one is about 2 hours long, so you get a bunch of really small-scale, asinine mysteries. The very first one involves one of the hands of Big Ben was just stolen in the middle of the night. And
was this Carmen Sandiego? Good lord.
No, it turns out that it melted.
Oh, okay. No, that's that checks out.
Because it rained, and and the hand had broken off, so the person who keeps Big Ben, has a twin brother who ran a bakery, so they made a giant cookie to replace the hand, and then it rained.
That's what I figured.
Well, I mean, it doesn't rain.
It very rarely rains.
Yeah.
So that's the first. But this was an emergency because they had international governorship traveling in, and they wanted to see Big Ben because that's a tourist attraction. Anyways, That's the very first mystery. I'm not going to spoil any mysteries beyond that.
So they put less care into writing this than they did when they wrote the late and right crossovers, what you're telling me.
No. There's a lot of care into this because you have Shirl, the talking dog, who's his name is short for Sherlock. We'll get to Sherlock later.
So we're in a Sony movie is what you're telling me.
We have the talking dog named Shirl. We have Catriel Layton and Catriel Layton's assistant who could not be crushing on her harder if he was stalking her anyways. He's obnoxious. I like to forget he exists. The writing is pretty good. Catriel is a really awesome character, really, really funny, really kind of genuine. It's a very different perspective. It's obviously a lot younger, but nowhere near as young and obnoxious as Luke. So it's a nice middle ground of this young adult woman who is also a glutton, who just loves eating everything.
That trope.
Yeah. But, is funny, whether she means to be or not. Shirl is non-stop, non-believing of just all the bullshit he's seeing. He's the character going around like, what the fuck is any of this? Why, this makes no sense. What are you doing?
That's an actual quote from the game, by the way. It's on the box.
Uh-huh. It's true. The box on the App Store? Yep.
But, level 5, they might.
But there's an elephant in the room that I've been talking about, and that's the puzzles. So Chris Kohler tweeted something that I retweeted a couple of days after the game came out, which was PSA. If you're in a puzzle in this game, and it asks you to input a number, the answer is either 1 or 0. Because it's always, what's the minimum number of combinations? And it's always 1 or 0.
What?
This game is the first Layton game to come out after the Puzzle Master died, and they got a new Puzzle Master.
Oh, I was worried about this.
Every single one is a trick question.
I was worried about
every
I
puzzle
like the trick
is
question ones, but if they're all trick questions, they're not trick questions.
Every puzzle, 10 minutes in, you'll realize it's like, I don't know, what's the least amount of people necessary to, like, I don't know, fix this broken machine? One person, just hire someone who can do it. Like, that kind of puzzles.
Oh my god. Is it ones like, six people, I came into the kitchen and all my cookies had been eaten. Six people were interviewed and each of them had a reason why they couldn't be the one. And
nope.
Tap the one that did it and then it turns out it's you. You have to tap the person in the foreground. Or is it not nearly that clever?
You get ones that are like, tap unexpected suspects, but you're not getting like interviews of six people that much. Like,
no.
Puzzles of that complexity aren't really in here. Let me put it this way. There was a 55 Picarot puzzle very early on that was a diagram of a bunch of lines seemingly crisscrossed, and it asked how many lines are there, and the answer was one, because it just kept connecting and weaving in on itself. And that was 55 Picarots. The puzzles in this game kind of suck.
That's really bad, because, like, for me, that's the appeal here. Like, yeah, the Layton bullshit's great, but you're telling me they've really dialed down the scale of what we're dealing with.
I like the
you're
scale
telling
is,
me there's
the
no,
scale
there's
is
no
lower.
Secret soundstage London somewhere.
The scale is diminished. The character, the writing is very good. If you're worried about the localization, because this is the first time Nintendo didn't localize this Layton game, don't worry. The localization is very, very good. The writing is very good. The characters are very good. I like the story, although it is on a smaller scale. The puzzles suck. I believe Chris Kohler also tweeted, once you finish, and I agree with this wholeheartedly, story B, characters A, writing B, puzzles D.
Ugh.
So, depending on the reason you come to Layton, maybe stay away from this one. It's about 20 to 30 hours long.
That's long.
Yeah, it's a long-ass game. And all the cutscenes are recorded video, which means that, by the way, when you launch a cutscene, you either rotate your phone to landscape, or you watch with 80% of the screen black.
Oh, nice.
You watch the aspect ratio real shrink down on your phone. That's not a problem with the 3DS version, but you're paying more than twice for an inferior version just for that headache. So, and I will say, just in case anyone's concerned, it's a one-time purchase that doesn't have to have constant online connectivity. So, so you can play it on a plane, etc., if you get it on your phone. It's not like Super Mario Run in that regard.
So, I'll ask this because I guess I care for some reason that I can't quite figure out. The previous Leighton spinoff starring his
the one they patched to support 64-bit made it so they crashed on boot up and then hid from the App Store.
Yeah, that one. which I'm blanking on its name, Leighton Brothers.
Leighton Brothers Mystery Detective bullshit, whatever. Yes?
Yeah. That one has a very, we'll call it tenuous relationship ultimately with the franchise.
Yeah, the one they don't talk about. Uh-huh.
Leighton Brothers Mystery Room is the name of that
that's
game.
That's the one.
To the point where it is questionable if the game was actually supposed to be a Leighton-related game to begin with. Does this game have any real connection to the Leighton world besides wearing the names? Do you encounter characters from the previous games or whatever?
Okay. First 15 minutes, you encounter Granny Riddleton, who's still alive at this point.
Well, yeah, she's an eternal demigod who grants you with puzzles about fucking matchsticks when you've lost them.
And you can time travel between chapters to actually go hunt for those. Because the locales change between chapters.
No, well, that was her role. Was like when you could no longer get to a place, she collected all the coin puzzles that the all-seeing eye indicated were missed and put them in one convenient location.
It's true. Like the mystery of why doesn't she ever talk about her dad? Like things like that. Like yes, those are all addressed. Like
okay,
this has a very direct connection with the rest of the Leighton series. This is 100% canon. This is. This is the seventh Leighton game if they hadn't already called a project that's still in development hell, Leighton 7.
That was awesome. So this game takes place like 20-something years in the future. So I assume at this point steampunk robots have a completely leveled London, or are we just like parts of it? Like how are we dealing with here? What's the city? What's the state of
so
affairs?
So Unbound Future took place in like 2008 London. This game takes place about 20 years later in 2017 London.
So is it ancient ruins have come to life and blown the city up, or is it like people with steampunk robots? What are we talking about here? Because there's no way the city's still standing in the Leighton universe. Like, that shit's fucking unreal.
I'm just gonna say that the scenarios are smaller in scale than the other Leighton games, and I'm not gonna spoil the twist for listeners.
This is depressing. Like, I want them to go like, yeah, there's parts of town we just don't go to anymore because the giant mechs are still fighting the ancient stone golems, and we just can't.
I found an Inazuma 11 reference. Anything for you?
I'm less hyped than I was a minute ago. Thanks, Mark.
So yeah, that's Leighton's mystery journey. If you want the story and the characters and the writing, go for it. But if you're looking for the puzzles, maybe stay away and go replay one of the older Leighton games. They've been talking a lot about a desire to remake Leighton and the Curious Village. And I might hold out for that one.
I would drop real money for a Switch version of that game.
That game did not age well. I went and revisited it early this year. Leighton game did not age well. So
its production value is very, very low relative. Even Diabolical Box, the production value is significantly higher. And then by the time the third game rolls around, like they're spending money.
Diabolical Box was the game where they had the innovation of letting you scribble down notes for puzzles.
Yeah.
Curious Village didn't even have that. So
yeah, like
yes.
that game is very, 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 very old at this point.
Yes. So that's Leighton. And then I've also been sinking a lot of time, even though I haven't finished it, because it's a lot longer than I expected, into Daigyakuten Saibon 2, which is the sequel to Daigyakuten Saibon 1.
What is that? I've never heard of that game.
Yeah, so those are Leighton games. Those are Ace Attorney games that are never coming over. Sorry, James. So
they could have just called him something besides. They could have just flipped the first letter of his last name and first name and said it's a parody and been done with it.
Sherl, like that?
Yeah. Or just he's Herlock like, Sholmes. We're done. Problem solved. I fixed it for you, Capcom. You stupid, stupid publisher.
No, actually, because can we have a spoiler warning? Can we have like a? Can we say go to the end of the chapter?
Coming out?
Yeah. Can we
sure.
say go to the end of the chapter if you don't? If you don't want to hear any spoilers,
how long are you gonna talk about the spoilers?
Like, will be chapter listings, but probably 5 minutes max.
Well, go ahead, and I'll make a chapter.
Okay. So here is the spoiler section for spoilers for the first game. There are not going to be spoilers for the second game in this segment.
In case you've learned Japanese in the interim.
Yes. Okay, so in the first game, one of the big mysteries was so Sherlock Holmes has an assistant, Iris Watson, who's the daughter of John Watson. And Iris Watson...
Who's a little girl.
Who's a little girl with pink hair and invents steampunk machines. No, this is London, excuse you. So...
No, this is Japan.
She's been writing the Strand magazine. She's been writing the Sherlock Holmes stories. And leaking them under her father's name. And she writes The Hounds of the Baskervilles. And Sherlock Holmes sees this story, this manuscript, and immediately tears it up. I think he strips some of the names from it and then donates it somewhere else so she doesn't have access to the manuscript or something like that. And but she's only ever referred to it as Baskervilles. And then Suzato, the person accompanying you, your assistant, she expresses pity to Iris in the first game about, like, oh, I really wanted to read Hound of the Baskervilles, and then everyone fucking freezes because no one had ever said the full name, and how could she possibly know the full name of this thing that hasn't been written yet? And then that's a mystery that was unresolved in the first game. There were a lot of unresolved mysteries in the first games, like this secret message that was double encoded in Morse code and ancient Japanese letters that when you international murders were taking place and like wars were going over to try and receive, you guys receive it and decode it, and it's the names of all of your characters.
Great.
With it in like a hit list. And that's never really discussed in the first game. And then also the prosecutor, who has a rumor around him that anyone who's found not guilty in a trial involving him mysteriously dies a couple days later. That's never resolved.
Oh, it's the ring, is what you're telling me.
So this second game has been resolving a lot of those mysteries. It has the most involved and interesting plot-related first case in an Ace Attorney game since Apollo Justice, Apollo Justice had a big twist in the first case that ended up coming in later.
Coming to 3DS soon.
Coming to 3DS in a couple months. I can talk about that now. But Digactin Saibon 2, the first case, the victim was someone that was found guilty in the first game on their way to an international trial. And also, maybe, this is playable in the web demo, so I guess it's not too big a spoiler. You don't play as Wright's grandfather, because even though everyone calls her that, you're playing as Suzato, who is masquerading as him because women can't be lawyers.
I thought you were going to say you're playing as Professor Layton, and I was going to go, all right, that's it. This segment's over.
No. So it's a lot of mysteries, a lot of resolution. I haven't finished it yet, but if it ends, I'm on case 4, and if it ends well, if the whole game ends well, this will exceed Daigyakuten Saibon 1 as my favorite Ace Attorney game, just to rub extra salt into James's wounds.
You can't hurt me more than Capcom already has.
I believe my two favorite Ace Attorney games are now the DGS games. And I think that's going to do it for my new business, unless you have any questions about this game that you haven't played, the sequel to a game you haven't played.
Yeah, I'm not even sure what they're holding this game hostage for anymore. Like, they made this game knowing what was going to happen.
Yes, this game was made for Japan only.
This isn't like the like Sony with the Ghostbusters movie. Like, wait, we can't release a movie about ghosts in China? Like, this is shit they knew. So yeah, I just a blight upon the video games industry.
Sure.
All right. Well, we're gonna move on because I don't want to talk about it anymore. So that's the criteria for moving on this podcast. Apparently, Greg.
Yes.
What have you been up to?
Oh, lots of things in a couple of weeks. Plenty more Splatoon 2. We had the Splatfest and all that kind of stuff. It was really cool that they had the ketchup and mayo colors for the teams.
Yeah.
Hell yeah, it was.
It did kind of make me a little queasy.
Yeah, it was not a good look. It was unpleasant.
I still, you know, thought it was a valid choice.
Were you team blood?
I was ketchup, yeah. I actually like both, but you know.
Fun fact: we're not Switch friends, so I didn't get to play with you. Even though I don't have any other European friends that chose Team Ketchup, and I'm in the European version.
There you go. I love it.
Okay.
So the beauty of that was like every single region looked exactly the same score wise, which like but just off by like 1%, which feels really dubious.
I don't know. It wasn't as much of a ketchup landslide in Europe for the voting. I think it was like, wasn't it like 70% in America?
Yeah, it was 70-30.
It was more like 60, I think, here.
Yeah.
So it still was, you know, a very big gap there.
I still kept playing Red v. Red.
Yeah, exactly. You ended up with a lot of that, and that was the second time for me.
And that's why
when
I
you
picked
had the
mayo.
Premiere, I was ice cream, and it was very much the same way. You know,
oh, yeah.
Lots of ice
team,
cream.
Team
ice cream.
Team cake didn't show up. Yeah. Yeah. I learned my lesson from that. Went with the mayo and actually got to play matches every single time. Which was good. Like I appreciate that. Like that, I like having to game this stupid Splatfest.
Any thoughts on the invisible flight thing that they've already, you know, confirmed for next month?
Are you a dreamer or a pervert?
That's you could be both.
I'm whichever indefensible bullshit position Marina takes.
So yeah, I'm. I wonder who writes these Splatfests at this point because
I just hope it's gonna be closer to 50-50 this time. But I kind of think flight will win a lot.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. I'm curious what the colors they'll pick for invisible or flight are. I really think invisible
it'll just be like cake and ice cream again, won't it? Probably
yeah.
Just not particularly.
I was thinking that maybe invisible ink for one side, then ink that never even touches the ground for the other.
All matches end 0-0.
To be fair, if he's going to go invisible ink, back to the whole clean versus dirty thing, it should be water.
It's true. That would be amazing, but that's never gonna happen. Sadly, that would be really fun. The one that got me was like so they've. I'm curious if they're gonna keep the Splatfest going at a good cadence because the last one ended what about a week and a half ago now?
It's same deal. First weekend of the month, so okay. You know, it seems like that's the pace.
They're just announcing them pretty early, and we just gotta wait it out.
Yeah.
So. What else have you been playing?
Yeah, I said plenty more Splatoon besides just the Splatfest stuff. I've got up to B's across the board in the rank battles. I'm up to level 24, which may be higher than I ever got on the Wii U version, even though, you know, I played it for a long time, kind of stretched out just because I can play this so much more, you know, densely. Because of the portable nature of it. Also did a bit of league battle for the first time. You know, cause you've got to get up to B minus at least, to participate in league. And I wanted to try it with, the pair sort of, function. So yeah, a friend of mine has got Splatoon 2. He also got up to B and then, we went in the same room, but obviously like online together playing in league. That was a whole hell of a lot of fun. That's probably the most fun I've had with Splatoon in either of its incarnations so far, because rank battle stuff is, yeah, I've said before, is kind of where I had the most fun with the game. But when you're actually, you know, consistently competing with a friend in the same room, especially like Rainmaker, where, you know, a lot of the time, you know, the, even though obviously, yeah, you've got another pair that you're playing with that, you know, they don't know what the hell you're doing or whatever, the just the two of you being on the same page, being able to coordinate, going in there with a plan, can really make a huge, you know, difference in the, you know, and being able to win a game. So, you know, he went in with like a roller type weapon, and then, you know, the plan was he'd just build a road if I got hold of the Rainmaker and just, you know, basically just lay out the ink carpet for me to go to the base, and it worked pretty well. Some crazy frantic stuff, you know, when they've got it and you're scrambling to stop them from scoring, all that kind of stuff is just, yeah, absolute hoot. I would love to be able to do sort of more of that more often, but, you know, even if it's only sort of like a occasional thing, it's, you know, a big kind of upgrade on what I was, you know, like I said, how I played Wii U Splatoon, because it just, well, first of all, my friend, funnily enough, didn't have Wii U, because it wasn't that popular. But also, but also, you know, the fact with this being, you know, a portable thing, and you can have your your own separate switches in the same room and all that, it just sets it up to be really, really intense and fun. So yeah, it's been great. Been put plenty of time into that. Found everything in the single player. Haven't done obviously every level with every weapon, because that's that would take a very long time indeed, but yeah, all the scrolls and that kind of stuff have been found. Yeah, that was, as you said yourself, James, I think there were some really kind of clever ways that they hid stuff, some obscure things that took me a while to find, but I got there in the end. So yeah, all that was good fun. But yeah, I also talk about I picked up Namco Museum for Switch. Been thinking about, you know, where I'm gonna dip my toe in with classic games on Switch, because I haven't got any of the Neo Geo stuff yet. But you know, this compilation kind of appealed to me because I like the idea of having the high score stuff, the leaderboards, and all that kind of thing. I like the idea of these challenge modes. Apparently, you know, I checked into it before. Picked it up about the, you know, the emulation quality and the display options. You can do the whole vertical mode thing, all that's good stuff. So I went with it, although I must say I did not buy it from the UK store, because it's a full £30 on there, which is just, that's not happening. So yeah, I got it from the Japanese store because I found a half decent deal on getting Japanese credit. And so I ended up saving about £8 getting it that way, which is,
isn't
not
it 3,000 yen, $30, £30, €30?
Yeah,
is it,
well,
like just the number 30 all across the board, regardless of conversion.
Yeah, it does seem that way. You know, it's funny actually with Japanese prices, because since they introduced that tax a few years ago, most of them are very individual. You know,
you're going to get 794 yen.
Yeah, the rounding is not such a thing anymore. You know, I could understand that back with, like, when it was introduced, like, affecting, the VC prices on Wii. Because it's like, okay, everything was for that old system. You know, all the different bands, you know, 600, 800, 1,000, whatever. And then this, you know, percentage tax comes in, and they have to tack it on. But I love the way that most games now are still priced like that. Like, it's like, okay, so this price is really sort of a weird integer because we wanted to charge you less, but the damn tax made us charge you more. Like that.
What, you don't like paying 7,572 yen?
Yeah, but especially when you're buying in blocks, you know, credit, because right. You know, it's very easy to access the other stores, but you're paying directly is not so easy. So yeah, that's how I've done it so far, is just, yeah, finding a decent deal on blocks of credit, you know, on websites, and then entering the code. But yeah, funnily enough, Namco Museum is just 3,000 flat. So that was perfect. I just got 3,000, you know, no random few yen just hanging around potentially unused for quite some time. And it worked out much better value. But yeah, most things the conversion is not that, like, punishing for pounds, you know, for people here. You know, Sonic Mania is £16 Rather than being 20, because it's $20, mm-hmm. for instance. So that's really what kind of put me off. I mean, it's been a point of discussion with the compilation in all territories that perhaps it's overpriced. You're talking about sort of 10 arcade classics plus Pac-Man Versus. Some people don't think that adds up all that well. For me, being able to get it at the price that I did get it for, I felt like it was a decent proposition. And so, yeah, so far I haven't spent that much time with every single game on there. Like, you've got a couple of Galaga games, Pac-Man, a couple of Rolling Thunders, Splatterhouse.
all the bangers.
Yeah, you got a tank force or something. It's something I'd never heard of. It's kind of a bit of an interesting one because it's almost you when you first look at it, it's a bit like Bomberman. It's like it's top down, almost kind of grid based combat, but with tanks, as you might imagine. But the twist here is you are sort of defending a base from all these other tanks that are coming in to destroy it. And you have mostly kind of destructible kind of scenery that makes up these levels. And you've got a bit of a tension between how much of the scenery do you want to destroy yourself so that you've got a decent sort of inroads to go and take out these enemies before they get to you. But of course, you know, if you destroy scenery, then it's easier for them to, and quicker for them to actually get to the base to attack it. So you've got some sort of strategy in there, a little tiny little bit, thinking about the best way to take these on. But it's mostly just kind of arcadey fun. And also the HD rumble really comes through on that because of the explosions. Hmm. It's a weird one with HD rumble because it hasn't made that much of an impression on me. I haven't played the games that probably make the biggest use out of it. And these arcade games seems like odd candidates to be sort of showing off the HD rumble, but in fact it's quite impressive how much it matches it in terms of like relative to the sound and visual effects, like in something like Rolling Thunder, if a grenade is dropped, the way that you get the sort of initial burst of rumble on the upon it exploding, but then this kind of little fading sort of tapering off rumble as the smoke clears and all that kind of stuff. It's they did put some amount of effort into that, and it's pretty good, but it was also a bit loud. It reminds in the hardware when you're playing in portable mode, it reminds me a bit of, do you remember the rumble pack for DS with the Metroid Prime Pinball and Hunters? It's not, obviously the rumble is better and it's the noise is not as obtrusive, but it does remind me of that. Compared,
it sounds
to,
like you had a razor going inside your DS. Yeah,
compared to other rumble stuff, but it was kind of like a neat little bonus thing I wasn't really expecting.
So I have to ask. Because I don't want to buy this, but there are three games I need to know if they're in there. Rolling Thunder.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh shit! Tower of Draga.
Yes.
Yeah. Fuck. And then is it Sky Kid?
Sky Kid's in there. Yeah.
Son of a bitch! I'm gonna have to buy this thing. Damn it, well, Namco.
Like I said, Rolling Thunder was the two Rolling Thunders were two of the ones I wanted to try the most. Like I mean, Galaga 88 is pretty good. I had the arcade version of that on the Japanese Wii Virtual Console. I think only the TG16 version of it was on the other Wii Virtual Consoles. I already like that, and I quite like the idea of being able to play it portably and in the vertical orientation, all that kind of stuff. But the Rolling Thunder games I had not played and was kind of really interested in. Famously very difficult. More like arcade Shinobi than like Contra or something, kind of more deliberate sort of situation with some mile platforming and shooting, very sort of kind of stodgy controls, and you got very, very careful with your shooting. You have actually got limited ammunition. But it's not as limiting as that might sound initially, in terms of, you have these rooms where you can reload, you have quite a generous amount of bullets, and you also, even when you're out, you still have like a single shot that you can pull off. But that's you are not Not entirely defenseless, but it's close, because like, if there's any sort of multiple enemies on screen, you might want to be able to shoot more than one bullet at once. But what it does do is it imposes a certain amount of discipline on you, that it's like, yeah, you can't just go in, you know, spraying randomly at enemies before they even appear on the screen, like, you know, kind of just trying to sort of, you know, cheese it where, you know, where they're going to spawn or whatever. You know, you need to know that you're going to hit, otherwise you're just going to run out of bullets really fast. So it's very deliberate, but and apparently it's got a ghouls and ghosts thing where you have to go around again.
Yeah, it does. Oh. So if you Fine. Need a good moment of joy, the Rolling Thunder 2 arcade poster, and then compare it with the Rolling Thunder 2 Genesis cover, because it's night in, like, the arcade poster could be a Bond poster. Like,
the sort of silhouette of a woman, very suggestive kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's because they have one of the borders for all the games is always like the arcade art, you know, the cabinet art.
Oh yeah,
you can choose other borders and stuff, but yeah. So I've literally seen this image while playing the Rolling Thunder 2 one.
The Genesis one is like Mega Man 1 on the NES. But with Genesis art. In fact, no, I want to record Greg's reaction to this. I'm going to send it right now because it's amazing. This is one of those like classic POS box art games. But what works great about it is that it's like also
pretty good.
It's bad. Oh man.
I don't even know. Like I've seen this box art for decades, and I still don't understand what's happening in it.
No, I mean it's interesting because they're quite far apart in time, relative. You know, the two games, Rolling Thunder and Rolling Thunder 2.
Was like. 2 was like 91, I think.
Yeah, like, so like 86 and 91, I think, which, you know, that 5 years is like quite a long time, you know, in the advancement of arcade games and the industry in general and all that kind of stuff. And what I've seen of them so far, you know, they're not terribly different, but aesthetically you've got some, you know, kind of fairly major differences in that you've a lot of kind of solid color in the first one, you know, so it's obviously a bit different from a lot of games that vintage, because you're talking about more like realistically proportioned characters and all this, because it's going for a retro spy thing. But like, so the way it kind of handles it is trying to sort of make it stylized with all these flat colors kind of thing, whereas the Rolling Thunder 2 is much more, you know, 16-bit, you know, what you're familiar with from the 16-bit consoles that, you know, later on kind of caught up to where that arcade game was, and you get some sort of sprite scaling effects and parallax and all that, you know, so it's definitely a lot more attractive, but it's also a lot more sort of conventional from what what you're used to at this point.
It's a full two Namco hardware generations apart.
Yeah.
I think it's on a System 2, and the original's on the Namco 86. So, like, there's a huge time gap here. Which, yeah, like, I've only ever played the first one. I'm damn it. Maybe I have to go buy these on the Wii Virtual Console and just call it that way.
Well, like I said, you know, for me, I was kind of interested with these two. That was definitely part of the equation. Being able to play some of the others, you know, in a more convenient format than what I've got them currently, that was part of the equation. Splatterhouse, I'm not a huge fan of. It's more like, it's closer to Altered Beast than it is to Streets of Rage as brawlers go. Although I do like it more than Altered Beast.
It's certainly more visually interesting than Altered
Beast. Yeah, the aesthetic is more interesting. I think the bosses, you know, kind of bring something to the table. I mean, the thing with the burlap bag over its head with the two chainsaws for arms is just horrifying. That is a nightmare creature. And really quite difficult to beat as well. But yeah, so like that's, it's kind of a fun inclusion to have in there. You know, and obviously this has the full suite of, like, you know, suspend feature and saving and all that. So if you just want to see the end of the game, you know, like, you can do that. whereas otherwise it might be quite difficult in a number of these cases. But the other thing, of course, Pac-Man Versus, you know, this, I've never played that before. I did get to do a quick test of it with a friend. So again, you got this, as we talked about before it came out, that app that you can download off the store for onto another Switch, and then, you know, you can get ready to play a bit of Pac-Man Versus. You got the ghosts, obviously, are going to be all on one screen. That's going to be up to three people, and then Pac-Man's going to be on the other, and then you kind of pass the Pac-Man Switch around, you know, to the person playing as Pac-Man, and try and hit a certain score from the different modes until somebody kind of wins the round. And, you know, so playing the 1v1 obviously is not the full kind of experience, because then you're talking about AI controlled ghosts kind of picking up the slack and stuff. But it was still pretty fun, you know, and I hope we'd get some more use out of it eventually. But the other thing is these challenge modes, which some of them are more kind of interesting than others. So, I mean, a lot of people kind of talked about this as being like a little bit half-baked, in terms of they could have gone further with it. So it's like, okay, we will kind of slice a little component of the game into a focus challenge, and then make that its own separate high score leaderboard. So you have a leaderboard for the games just for the, you know, the score in general, but then you have a separate mode which is kind of, like I said, usually focused around one particular aspect of that game, and then that's its own little high score, you know, realm. And the most successful ones are ones that kind of look at a particular facet of the gameplay of a game and build a high score challenge around that. So with Galaga, the original Galaga, it's about the whole mechanic of a ship getting captured and then retrieving it. That, you know, so you get, you know, a scoring system based around retrieving ships, and it just gives you, you know, all the lives you could want to play with, but then a time limit, and you just focus on that. In Dig Dug, it's about crushing enemies with the boulders that are in that. You know, I mean, in general, you know, you kill enemies by shooting the harpoon into them and then just, you know, pumping them up until they pop. But you can also kind of, you know, more like, you know, Pac-Man style, like get them to follow you and then sort of set it up so that you get you let a boulder drop and kill a whole bunch of them at once. You've got a challenge centered around that. And then for Galaga 88, you've got a challenge set up around the sort of galactic dancing little interstitial levels in those games and getting perfect scores on those and stuff. But then with a lot of the other games, it's like, oh, here's the last level and infinite lives, and just do as well as you can. And those are not as interesting. Those don't kind of, for me, like with Dig Dug especially, which I got no experience of, it was actually a cool way to kind of get me up to speed with the game. That little, you know, challenge thing kind of gave me a better idea of how the mechanics work in the game and what you can achieve in it. Whereas, yeah, just like playing the last level with infinite lives is meh. You know, I guess it's nice to see it if it's something you might otherwise struggle to see, which certainly could be true with, like, the Rolling Thunder games. But, yeah, you know, it feels like a strain in to come up with something that really justifies, like, a separate challenge mode or, you know, leaderboard for some of these games. But still, you know, I've really enjoyed my time with it so far. I love the fact that you've got all these different display options. I've dug out the Kid Icarus stand and used it for the first time ever to actually do the Tarte mode thing. I never used it.
Send
with
a thank you letter to Sakurai.
I never used it with Kid Icarus Uprising, shockingly. I'm sure that comes as a tremendous shock to our listeners. But yeah, I did. It's not obviously ideal or all that stable for this purpose, but I haven't got a dedicated stand yet, so I just did that to have a look, and it was nice. But what you've got, you know, you can pretty much do just about anything. You can can rotate the display to do Tarte mode. You can resize it however you like. You got your choice of backgrounds. But for me, the biggest thing is that you've got what's referred to in the options of this as fixed dot size, which is a little bit vague, but you know, what you're basically talking about is original resolution and then integer scaling of that. So what you're not going to get is any of that weird kind of scaling that you get with like Blaster Master Zero, if you remember when I spoke about that, the way that you get that kind of strange stuff that popped up on Switch with that. You're not going to get any of that because you just, you know, like I said, you've got various options about how, you know, what kind of scaling you're going to do of the original resolution. And you can, you know, do it. That's different, obviously, on the TV when it's docked than it is for the regular one. So you might fiddle about a bit getting different, you know, your favorite kind of display set up for different orientations or different games and whether it's docked or portable, but you can't argue with the options. It's just so flexible that, you know, you're going to be able to make the games look good. And they do look really sharp on the Switch screen, which is what you're looking for. Just pin sharp. Some of these games didn't exactly pretty, you know, look through modern eyes, but you couldn't really represent them that much better, I don't think, than the way they look here.
Cool. Well, now I don't want to buy this, but we may be getting to the point where I need to, because we still don't have a virtual console yet, so.
Yeah, it's nice having just a bunch of classic games just there digitally to play at the moment. And also, these arcade games, I don't really feel the absence of the D-pad too much when I'm playing them portably, because none of them are really that much about, like, finessing directions, right, like it would be if you like land in a jump in Mario or weave in between bullets in a hardcore shoot 'em up or something like that. It's a lot, kind of like Rolling Thunder itself, a lot of it's a lot more kind of discreet and deliberate, and that fits the separate button D-pad relatively well.
And it's important to remember that Namco pretty much designed all their games of that era to also be played in the coffee table configuration. So
yeah.
There's a certain amount of fidelity that's difficult in that posturing. So they may have just, you know, they may just be baked into the design of these games. Cool. Well, I'm going to talk about something completely different and then lie to you, because I have been playing Rare Replay on the Xbox One. So
have you though?
I have, for reasons. This was actually sent to me by John, who's not here, for me to thank him for it. Because he got a copy of it digitally for free, and he had never even opened it. So it was unopened when I got a hold of it. I know that's shocking. And he actually sent me two other games. He sent me Evolve, which was opened, and Sunset Overdrive, which also was unopened.
He hates you if he sent you Evolve.
Well, I think he's just getting rid of it. I think he just wanted it out of his house. Because I don't think anybody's playing it right now, so it would be very difficult for me to actually get any value out of it. But that's okay.
People are playing it. It just got on the Humble sale for PS4.
Oh, okay. So I've been playing Rare Replay, and I actually streamed all the time I played it so far. I went and I played, went through every game chronologically up through RC Pro-Am, 1987's RC Pro-Am.
So that's all the games I haven't touched in Rare Replay.
Yeah, all the shit that's just completely unintelligible. So this game, if you're not familiar with it, was came out a few years ago now, 2015, I think. But basically, it was for the 30th anniversary of Rare, or as they were founded, Ultimate Play the Game, which is the worst fucking name for a company besides Mixed Bag, who now holds that current title. But basically, they picked 30 games from their history to try to represent, you know, the fullness of what Rare is, and it's legacy, assuming the game isn't currently owned by Nintendo, and put them on this Xbox One package, and they wrapped it in all this presentation land. Gorgeous artwork, like amazing remixes of computers' sounds that were like from 2-bit processors. I mean, literally 2-bit processors, not like that's a 2-bit processor you've got right there. A tremendous amount of work went into this package. And there are games downstream that further down the chronology that are just, you know, they backwards compatibilized the 360 version of a game, you know, so like Banjo-Tooie, Banjo-Kazooie, Those are the 360 versions of that game, which were ports from the N64 version, and then they just made them backwards compatible. So there's a bunch of those. But I have played so far Jetpack. Actually, let's just go through them in order. I'll talk about it a little bit. Jetpack, I would describe this as something that you probably would have played on like an Apple II as edutainment software. Basically, you go around and you collect pieces of a rocket, you deposit them, you get fuel, and then you fly away. You also shoot at the pom-pom looking things from the McDonald's commercials that were made out of French fries. That's pretty much Jetpack 2. That's the whole game. The jetpack comes to the fact that you are, in fact, wearing a jetpack. You just keep refilling the rocket and flying off until you die. And that's it. It's a Spectrum game, and it sure is a ZX Spectrum game. The next game that they had on there is Lunar Jetman. This game is completely incomprehensible.
Are you sure? Because I managed to beat it.
Because it's all right. Here's the thing about Lunar Jetman: you have to get a bomb to an alien base and blow it up. You put the bomb on your little buggy and drive it to the base. But if there's a hole in the ground, like a divot, the buggy can't go over it because reasons. And if you die, it puts a hole in the ground. So if you die twice, one on each side of the buggy, you can't move the buggy. So you have to carry the bomb over to the base. And it's just, it's some, this is a game that was available on a cassette for £4 in like shops in London. That's what this game is. And that's what this game deserves to be. It is again, another Spectrum game. It's weird and basic and very simple kind of game to it. And also not particularly enjoyable. But, it's interesting question mark.
That is not
Attic Attack.
A Tick Attack.
A Tick Attack? Oh, I don't know what the hell to call this. This game is interesting with an exclamation point. Good with a question mark, a frowny face, and then just like the ink starts to kind of run out of the pen, so like the last letter is just sort of like chiseled into the paper. There's not really any ink in place.
Just because you didn't spend the 15 hours to learn how to play it.
It's a maze with just random-ass items on the ground that, again, because this is a Spectrum game, it looks like a Virtual Boy with, like, two extra colors. That's basically the graphics of this game. It's just, like, stark red lines on a black background, and then occasionally, like, some scribbled-on, like, icons spread around the map. It's, you go through a mansion, you unlock doors, and you try to find the pieces of a gold key, and then you get killed a lot. That's pretty much it. It's isometric, and it was praised for these graphics at the time because, again, this is a Spectrum game, and you know, it's not got a giant border around 2/3 of the game because that's all it could render. Just 1/3 of the game. Saberwolf, which is an actual video game. I'm not sure I would call it good, but it is a real video game. It's another maze game. They liked a lot of these maze games. There are hazards you have to kind of get around, and again, you're trying to work your way through a maze. It's dramatically more visually interesting, but it's not like isometric over the head shoulder. It's like scrolling, but it again is a weird. I don't like all these games are weird. All right, Saran, how would you describe Saberwolf?
It is a hellish piece of software where you get put in the middle of
it's a maze.
It's not procedurally generated, but you're put in a random room in the maze every time you spawn.
Yeah.
Every, let's say, 20 real-time seconds, you transform between wolf and human, and I have it. And it is unclear how far your jump can go in each, because every different room you might be at a different isometric angle. So the depth perception is completely shot. And some spikes kill you, some don't. And it works real good when you hold down the menu button on the Xbox One controller and hit leave game.
It does a good job of that. I do want to give this game a little bit of credit though, because the Crash Magazine, which was a magazine of the mid 80s, I guess all it went to the very early 90s, a UK gaming publisher for Spectrum, gave this game an award, quote, the best maze game of 1984, which tells you where video games were in 1984, that was a category. And in fact, there's two 1984 Maze games on Rare Replay alone, except I'm lying to you, because there's three. There's Underworld, which is the sequel to Saberwolf.
And is additionally hellish.
Yeah, it's different. it's a maze game. It doesn't look as nice as Saberwolf, but like the physics, this game has physics. Like they learned physics. Somebody when they were making this game read a book about physics.
No, they didn't learn actual physics.
This game has physics. I didn't say they're good physics, but there are physics in this game. There's physics in the standpoint of, hey, have you heard of physics? We should put physics in our game. Because you have about zero mass, and then when the enemies hit you, you go flying in basically random directions. Which would be not so bad, except for the fact it's a platformer maze. And one point to get out of. In fact, I'm looking at the Wikipedia article right now, and the screenshot of the gameplay is Saberman underwater with two bubble generators on the ground, which you can ride to go back to the surface, and just surrounded by a swarm of enemies who are homing into him. This is the exact same screen I got stuck on playing the game the other day because every time I got on a bubble, one of these stupid things knocked me off.
So I think the thing that you're underselling that you actually should be highlighting is the fact that not only do you not have mass, you can ricochet just between walls. So you become a bouncy ball. As soon as you jump in this platformer, you jump on like a bookshelf and it will just fling you three screens to the right and then down a pit and then you can't get back up.
Saberman is made of rubber, basically. It took me what? I tried to get off that screen for at least 2 minutes and just get being knocked
2 to 3 minutes.
Knocked off the bubble by the enemies. And they follow you from screen to screen. So as you run from them, you just have more and more of them on screen and the game starts to behave worse and worse because the game can't handle it. Because again, this is a specy game. It's not, you know, it is what it is. Night Lore, which is yet another one of these, because I don't know why.
It's another maze game. Saberman was their mascot.
It's another maze game. This one's from a completely new angle. They haven't done this angle yet. You're looking into the room like it's a diorama, but it's coming from like the front corner. You're like not head on. You're like looking at it from a corner to give it sort of the perception of 3D. But that also means your depth perception is completely screwed up because it's hard to tell exactly where in the room you are relative to anything else. Also, everything is one color because, again, spectrum. So, like, good luck figuring out what you're looking at about 60% of the time. But, again, another maze game. It's good to know that the first maze game they released was best maze game of 1984, meaning the other two were just completely superfluous. I played Gunfright.
Because they did come out the same year.
All three of those games came out the same year from the same two people. The Stampers made all of those games. It's unbelievable.
I got Saberwolf and Night Lore mixed up.
You didn't.
Saberwolf, you're not turning into a werewolf.
Night Lore is, yes. You're right, yeah. Yes. Night Lore does that. But beyond that, all these games are interchangeable. Just different angles and whatever random bullshit thing screws with you. Then there was Gunfright, which guess what Gunfright is? It's got a maze and you wander around and you shoot people.
Yeah, but this one starts with a shooting gallery.
It does. We shoot money. I don't know why. You shoot money. This game, because you're moving through a big space, does use the Spectrum standard. 2/3 of the screen is menus, or HUD. Basically, you're wandering around town looking for Buffalo Bill because there's a reward on his head, dead or alive. And people point at the general direction he is hiding in, and you just kind of follow them Where's Waldo style until you find him. The problem is everyone kills you when you touch them. Even the people who aren't him.
Do you think you would have figured any of that out if there weren't people in the chat telling you how these games worked?
I would have figured out you die every time you touch somebody, because you saw how I handled that. I just shot everyone, because that's what a good sheriff does. This game is completely screwed up. And I was, my price for running using my gun was eating into the reward I hadn't claimed yet. Because if you touch people, you basically explode. We call it an introvert's dilemma. Then I played Slalom, which is an NES game. It came out in 86. It's a real video game. Like, this is a video game where its intention is straightforward. You go downhill and you pass between gates. There's a bunch of shit on the slopes, though. Like, unbelievable amount of crap. Like, hilarious. Why is so much tree? Why are there so many trees on the ski slope? Levels of crap. But again, it's an actual video game that can be explained visually. You don't have to have someone with a codex there explaining what the purpose of the block you're pushing around is.
Is that the first Western developed Famicom/NES game? It's got to be.
It might be.
One of the earliest.
It's 80, I mean, it's 86. Like, it's got to be close. And then, finally, the last game I've played so far, RC Pro-Am, a game people actually care about.
Real quick, Slalom was the first.
Okay.
Yeah.
RC Pro-Am is a racing game where you control RC cars. I guess you just know that because they have little antennas on. They could be, you know, you could pretend they're pickup trucks if you want. But the reason that matters is because the angle you view it from is as if you're watching, like, an RC track from, you know, off the side of it. Which means sometimes your control is kind of goofy. Like, you have to kind of, in your head, sort of like, okay, I know I'm going to turn left here, but it's perspective, so, like, it's left relative to the car. And sometimes that can screw with you. And because the car kind of has, like, discrete angles it can be at, if you hold left or right too long, you can end up, like, backwards. And there's not much to it, but, like, it's a functional game. And it's got a good theme song. And the remix of it in the menu for the game is amazing. And it might be the best thing I've seen in Rare Replay so far, which is saying a lot. But up next, I've got Cobra Triangle, which I like. And in fact, I lied. I did play a little bit of that today, but I didn't stream it. I just poked my head in there. It's weird. You're a snake and you eat stuff.
It's kind of like you're following on from RC Pro-Am, isn't it? You know, the perspective and there's some racing and stuff, you know, but also some action and all that kind of stuff.
And Greg got on my joke because I was going to say it's a snake and you eat stuff. Oh no, that's Snake Rattle and Roll. Because they went on this like string of like games having weird names. So yeah, Cobra Triangle, you control a boat, and it's a racing combat game. I guess is the best way to describe it.
Snake Rattle and Roll.
Snake Rattle and Roll is the one where you are a snake's head and you eat things and you grow a body that's made of balls.
And it's a isometric platformer. Yes,
it is. Yeah,
it is something.
Yeah, like they really like their isometric games, and guess what?
That's the legacy of coming out of that British microcomputer gaming scene.
It really is, like, because I mean, playing Cobra Triangle and Snake Rattle and Roll RC Pro-Am, like, those feel like games that could have been on like the Sinclair or like a Commodore. Like, there's this weird, like, there's tons of HUD. There's weird angles of viewing where you're like, why am I looking at it from three quarters angle? This is terrible. But that's just sort of like what those games were, and they just translated that gameplay right over to the NES because nobody asked for it. But there it is. Up next are things like Solar Jetman and Digger T-Rock. So look forward to that. But yeah, on that, Guillaume.
Yes?
What have you been up to, sir? It's been a long time since we talked.
Oh my god. So many things. So many things.
Why don't you count us down with a game, you know, one or two games, if you get my drift?
I had reserved from the library, I had ordered a copy of 1-2 Switch for my get-together from last episode, where I talked about the much better, spoilers, Death Squared. And but I received the copy late. Too late to enjoy with my friends.
It was a warning.
Yeah, probably. But still, because it's summer, instead of having the game for a week, I have the game for a whole month. So plenty of time to dig in the deep games of 1-2 Switch. Probably not gonna take a month. 1-2 Switch is pretty much everything that, you know, people who warn you against 1-2 Switch tell you it is. It feels like, to me, it feels like playing a collection of the demos that they had for the Wii U when it was first unveiled, but that's not very evocative for a whole lot of people. So instead, I'm going to describe it as kind of imagine that you're playing Brain Age, doing some arithmetics. I don't know where to put the stress on that word. Arithmetics? Arithmetics?
Arithmetic.
Arithmetic?
Arithmetics?
Sure.
Good enough.
It's not plural. It's plural and singular.
Ah, I see. Okay. So doing some additions.
Some math. But you can't use math because depending on where you are, they do pluralize it. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah, but also you might think of the Jaguar marketing, mightn't you? So.
Yeah.
Imagine playing some Brain Age, doing some math, some additions. The two players, I guess you're competing to do the math faster. And yeah, it kind of stops after every time that you do one addition, and then you have to go through the menu again to play again. And if you play again, it's mostly the same. It might be a slightly different addition, but it's still going to be the same thing. And you repeat ad nauseam. Also a word I don't know how to say. Why do I do this to myself?
It's how we learn.
You think in text. That speaks to your vocation, probably.
Like it just feels like it's barely a collection of games. Like it's more like an activity that you can. Well, it's like a bunch
box
of activities.
Quote of 2017.
I prefer to think of it as a collection of barely games.
Yeah, well, it's just weird because like. I don't know, in a collection of mini games, usually Nintendo has been trying to put kind of a wrapping around it, right? Like, at the very least,
degree of artifice to connect it all together.
Right, or, you know, at the very least, there's some incentive to improve, I guess, if you're into, like, improving your Mii's, you know, ranking or score or whatever it is that they called it in Wii Sports. Like, you could keep playing against tougher and tougher AI opponents, and, you know, like you could see kind of a, you know, on a graph, like your progress, and that could be satisfying, you know, for some people. But this game doesn't have that. Like, there's no
one of those people.
Well, I don't know. I got into it in Wii Sports Resort.
Okay,
so
I just wanted to either subtly dig at judgmentalness or give you a bailout.
Yeah, well, so Wii Sports Resort, you know, like, you could get into that, and then, you know, you got, like, a floral, you know, Hawaiian t-shirt when you obtained a certain score. So that was an
Screw
incentive.
Screw you, achievements.
That's right.
Seriously.
I have a bowling ball that's got more patterns to it.
Yep, but unfortunately, like, in 1-2 Switch, like, you there's no Miis. There's no, like, you don't enter your name. I guess it's to keep like the games going, and I guess they correctly assume that playing with just one other person, it would get boring fast, so I guess they're hoping that you're going to be playing with a big gang and, like, you know, pass the controllers around, and hopefully everyone is drunk enough to think that
they better
it is
be a
fun.
Chain gang or they're going to run off.
But yeah, so it's not really... It's really not working for me. Like, it's just like, okay, like the game of telephone where you put the Joy-Con on a flat surface in front of you,
sucks.
A table. Yeah, and, you know, like you wait until the phone rings on the TV and you got to be the first one to pick up and say hello. So Karen won that one. She picked it up and said hello, even though there's no microphone. But, you know, it helps if you try at least a little bit to get into it, to pretend.
If you pretend you're having fun.
Yeah. And I, on the other hand, as I knew would happen, I just knocked the Joy-Con into, like, the cup that was next to it. And just thankfully, like, nothing fell off the table. But... anyway, so another great game. And then, like, once you're done with that, you can start it again, I suppose.
That was a real bummer when you had the same experience with the baby game.
We did play the baby game. I did fairly well on that, despite the fact that it woke up again when I tried to put it, you know, in its crib, quote-unquote.
True to life.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, there's nothing I can point to that I could say was, like, especially fun. Like, even the more kind of interesting games are, feel at the very best, like a Wii Play minigame. It feels like a demo for a controller that you already kind of know how it works.
Right.
And,
except it doesn't come with a free controller like Wii Play did.
It does not. And it also kind of, for a game that's supposed to be all about, like, passing the controller around and kind of, like, surprising people or, like, being goofy and stuff, like, it's surprising how the controls are poorly explained most of the time. And so, like, the first time that people play the quick draw game, I don't know, in my experience, they press on the wrong button as a trigger. Like, it's not, you know, it's not immediately obvious to them that the ZL is going to be, you know, the trigger for shooting. Like, it's, I don't know. Yeah, like, a lot of the mini games are actually kind of poorly explained.
Yeah, I could see that being one of those things where, like, okay, if you play a lot of video games, you might put your finger there intuitively, but otherwise, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. Like, so I played with Karen one evening.
Were you sober?
Yeah, we were.
Okay, well, then you've already violated the marketing material.
Yeah, I know. But then we played it, and, you know, that's one context where the game could be fun. The other context that it could be fun in is if you've got kids around. And so Karen's brother was visiting and with, like, the nephew and nieces. So they got into milk, where you're milking a ghost cow. So that's kind of fun. What else
did they play? The prog rock album.
I've tried playing the game with young kids, but it's also rated E10 because there are some minigames that have guns, and the parent was right there and didn't want guns, so we couldn't use shuffle, which meant that it was just a constant flip through, just trying to give a one sentence explanation of each game. Like, okay, in this game we're going to do this. Do you want to do this? And the answer is no.
Right. Yeah. Like, I can't even remember what they played. What did they get into?
I'm sure they were just disappointed that no one could be Spike. I think that would probably be the biggest draw, but...
Said no one ever.
They did play the treasure chest game where you're kind of trying to untangle a treasure chest that's, you know, tangled in a
chain. Is that even in there? What does that even show off about the system?
Yeah, I don't know, but you just, like, you kind of move around, like, the Joy-Con, and using the motion controller, you're unraveling this thing. And it's like, yeah, it feels like, you know, a Wii Play Motion minigame. And the thing is, like, I like motion controls in games. Like, I really liked Wii Sports Resort. I like motion controls that are done well. But in this game, like, it kind of made me lose faith in the technology behind the Joy-Con. Because, like, when I tried to play Signal Flags, which just has you, like, you know, signaling, like, the game tells you up and you move your arm up and down and left and right. And most of the time I just felt like it wasn't registering correctly. So it was kind of a frustrating experience. And, you know, like, even the kids, like, they enjoyed it to a point, but eventually, you know, when the youngest one keeps losing and starts spouting, then that's no fun for anyone. So, yeah, I don't know. A good experience.
Well, I have good news for you about that. I'm looking at the 1-2 Switch Wikipedia article because I wanted to ask about some of the games, and then I got bored reading the games, so I decided not to ask about them. But the paragraph under development is four lines. We'll call it 3.5. Two of which are devoted to the fact that they spent Nintendo of America reps were sent to a dairy farm in Vermont to promote the game.
Great.
So full half of the write-up of this game's development is about a trip to a dairy farm. 1-2 Switch, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. In short, support your public libraries. I'm glad that I could get my hands on this document for free. And,
it's on this book.
Yeah, and that I did not have to pay for my curiosity. I paid it, in, you know, with my time, but not my money. So that's good.
So yeah, I would actually go ahead and buy the novelization of 1-2 Switch, to be fair. Probably better than, like, the 1-2 novelization of Gex.
Seriously, like, it's surprising just how poorly the videos explain the games. Like, they really went more for kind of the goofy thing.
You're not kidding.
Yeah, I had serious problem with.
Did you try
some
sneaky dice?
I don't know. I saw that you recommended me that as one of the.
So it's a version of Liar's Dice, which is a fairly complex game. It's easily the most complex game in 1-2 Switch. You watch the video and it explains some of the rules, and then you hit the button to sign in, and as you're all leaning forward to start shaking, it just stops you for a couple seconds and gives you the other half of the instructions just real quick.
Oh my god. Yeah,
it's
It's
kind of insufferable. Also, does not work with little kids, because it's all about listening to rules, processing them, and then, like, using, like, reverse psychology to trick someone into reshaking their good role. Also, the HD Rumble doesn't always communicate what the other person's role is. If you have your, if you're holding the Joy-Con to the ground, and if it's in the air, the HD Rumble is so loud that they can hear what their own role is. It's kind of really bad.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and, like, the game has you kind of taking off and putting on the straps all the time, and that's another
constantly annoyance.
Oh, yeah. God.
So, you know, and, like, in some of the minigames, yeah, you don't want to throw your Joy-Con around, like...
No, I can imagine it's actually warranted in some of these cases, but...
Yeah, but you also want to take it off when it tell you because of the way that you're going to have to, like, position the Joy-Con.
But you get the phrase industrial milking accident if you don't wear the strap. Which is also a prog rock album.
Yeah, so that's basically all I have to say about that. Other than that, like I upgraded my phone after all my whining, and so I've got my own copy of Super Mario Run, and I discovered the first the kind of the single player for myself, and I still enjoy this game, so that's pretty good. Even though no one else is still playing it, it's still a fun game if you haven't played it.
Welcome to mobile games, Guillaume. All right, well, that's going to do it for an extended new business for our return to podcasting. When we come back, we'll have a couple listener mail. So, stick around. We are back with listener mail. You can send your emails to rfn at nintendoworldreport.com, and we... very well may just address them on the show. I would say answer, but sometimes they're just comments, and you can't really answer a comment. You can respond to it, but you can't really.
That is
the
main reason why there's a deficiency in answers. Yes, that's right.
Yeah, not just the fact that I'm stalling because I've looked at our emails and gone, oh boy, this could go places, and I'm scared. But let's just go. The very first step is always the hardest. Saran, why don't you read the first email?
Sure. Anna writes, what kind of new ideas or features would you like to see implemented in the new Fire Emblem being made for Switch? This is the one for releasing in 2018, not Fire Emblem Warriors.
The one that exists totally as the year 2018 on a black screen.
I'll go first. I want to see them expand the support... like the supports. One thing that is sometimes frustrating about like Fire Emblem Awakening and Fire Emblem Fates is that just so inexplicably, like some characters, like Reyna in Fire Emblem Fates, only has once a support with one character, and that's the Avatar, but feels like not as connected to your army because they can't talk. She can't talk to literally anybody else.
There were a few of those in Echoes.
Yeah. And so...
sometimes it was like two characters can only talk to each other.
And so there is a hack/mod for Fire Emblem Fates on 3DS that adds in S-rank supports for people of same sex. It's called like the Gay Marriage Expansion. But what they also have done is they've gone in and written C through S for a lot of pairings that didn't have it in general. Just like not even just like homosexual ones, just like... every character can now actually have a conversation with other characters, and I would like to see them take more further steps to that approach in an official capacity.
So I've played a lot of Fire Emblem lately. Way too much Fire Emblem. Just the Fire Emblem buffet is all you can eat. And I am currently on like my fourth trip, and the question now is, can I make it to my car? Because I've got the Fire Emblem product is raining from the skies, and it cannot be stopped. So, I mean, I made the bar chart, and the bar chart was like 7 1 year and like 4 the year before, and I forgot that technically speaking, Tokyo Mirage Sessions is a Fire Emblem product. Actually, the bar chart is missing a game. So, this is just product. Everywhere is product. So, what I want out of this game is for it to not feel like product. And that sounds, you know, weird, but my reference for that is Fire Emblem Echoes, Shadows of Valentia, had ideas in it that came from the Gaiden game. Ideas that maybe were evolutionary dead ends.
Ideas like the plot?
The plot actually works in that game and is somewhat mature in ways that some of the older Fire Emblem games were. Although in many ways it was more messianic, it felt less messianic because it wasn't just like, hey, big brother, you're going to save the world. No, he's my big brother. He's also going to save the world. It's like, shut up. Everyone shut the fuck up. I want everyone to go away. But like, I want the game to feel like it's taking risks. That game especially felt like it took risks. Awakening, it had some departures from the orthodoxy of Fire Emblem visually and stylistically and how it told stories and, yeah, how it handled relationships. Like, it took steps away from what those games were and livened up the series and made it feel a little bit less of an era. But, you know, I felt like Awakening and Fates, it wasn't safe because they made a shit ton of it. But and they made all kinds of weird difficulty modifying versions of the game, and like, you could get your super hard version, you can get your super easy version, you can get your middle of the road version, but you shouldn't play that one unless you played the other two, which was weird that the middle difficulty version was the third one they wanted you to play. But like, Echoes did things different. You know, it had the caves, which I don't know that I'd want the caves to come back, but I appreciated that they were there. Like, they were a nice change of pace. The battles felt different because of how they were structured and how the gameplay moved. You know, there's no weapons triangle in this game. Like, because Gaiden didn't have it. There's no, you know, the rock, paper, scissors stuff is just gone. The only real example of that is archers shoot down flying units. But otherwise, a lot of units are kind of, you know, there's not that weird, like, everything is a single use unit, so you have to kind of put the exact right unit in the right place. There's not a bunch of kiting units around to walk into their demise, because everybody who you build correctly is good, and everybody who you don't build correctly is useless. And it's really just about having a good team and having a team that's built right and developed properly. And it felt tactically freeing. So take a risk, be willing to dump some of the series orthodoxy. And you know, I'll give a specific of the weapons triangle, but it doesn't have to be that. But, like, God, that made the game feel at the same time more difficult and also more free. And that was so much Fire Emblem product. Fire Emblem Warriors, Fire Emblem Heroes, 3 fucking Fire Emblem Fates. Like, it felt different and exciting.
I'm going to take this point to say that I've just recently been replaying all 3 Fire Emblem Heroes or Fire Emblem Fates games because I haven't had enough Fire Emblem.
Yeah, moving on. All right.
I have two questions for the panel.
I moved on.
No, just about it's on topic.
Okay.
Would you like to see Kazaki-san's artwork? He did, that was the art style for Awakening and Fates, or the more traditional, like, Fire Emblem Echoes, Shadows of Valentia art style?
I actually like, so the thing about the old Fire Emblem games is that everybody was kind of, most characters were kind of wearing variations on a theme if they had armor. Like, it was like the same armor, just different colors.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the characters weren't super detailed. Like, there was nice art, but it wasn't like, you know, there wasn't like intricate design for every person's clothing. It's like, some characters had that, but a lot of them were kind of generic-y. Echoes has the old art style. It has kind of the muted color palette. But everybody looks cool. Everybody's got like a design thing going on about them that works for them, that goes well with their character. And like, I liked that. I liked that a lot. I liked Awakening a lot, character design style. I thought Fates went a little too hard into it. Like, they leaned a little too much into the tropes, I felt. But undeniably, they did a good job designing those characters. It's just like, I think I just like the change of pace. And I think the muted color palette works for that series in some ways. But I understand that part of what made made Awakening liven up the series was they ditched the muted colors. They said, bright colors, everything screams off the screen at you. Vibrancy everywhere. And that's how we're gonna push this game. So, you know, keep it fresh is probably the best answer I have to that. And, you know, after effectively four games of that art style, and really, Heroes? Damn, which one's which?
Heroes is the mobile game.
Heroes leans into that art style pretty hard, even when they're using other artists.
I mean, like different artists kind of, for every portrait, yeah.
But they're still kind of using, like, the bright colors pop off the screen kind of stuff. Seeing that muted color palette, but delivered with a level of detail that the series really hasn't had before was nice.
Mm-hmm. My second question is, how many Annas?
Infinite. I want a game of all Annas. There. Fire Emblem 2018. It's all Annas. Nobody can buy anything because nobody is there to actually sell stuff. All right. Guillaume, you have a thought?
I'm not a... Like, I keep bouncing off every Fire Emblem game that I've tried, so I've just resigned myself to the fact that I don't like the series, despite really wanting to enjoy it. And,
would you like to see them sort of... The feature you'd like to see implemented is they sort of discover technology and it becomes Advance Wars?
you ruined my joke. I was going to say first, you know, no missing. When you attack, you just, like, you know exactly what the chances are and how hard it's going to hit, and all of that good stuff, you know, creating units and everything. So yeah, like I do enjoy Advance Wars much more because there's much less story, I suppose, and also because none of that, like, random generator kind of thing. I don't enjoy that in its role in leveling up your characters. I don't enjoy, like, missing, even though, like, I got 99% chance of hitting. All of that stuff needs to go before I can actually enjoy a Fire Emblem game.
I was gonna say, I'm fine with the dice rolls for, like, accuracy and criticals. For me, I agree, they should change up their level up system. It is really frustrating to go from level 4 to level 5 and not get any benefits.
So that's still happening, huh? Like, I know it happened a lot in the GameCube game.
That still happens, and it's still possible. There's still a small chance that you get literally no extra points. Not even just +1 into, like, defense, like, right. And your character will be like, aw, that sucks. But, like, there's still a chance that you'll get literally nothing.
Yeah.
That happens a lot in, I mean, relatively speaking, it echoes.
Yeah, like, because that's harsher. Where it's like,
Yeah, that I have had characters who didn't get any stats for two levels in a row, and that was kind of bullshit.
So okay. Well, they should rework that.
Yeah, I was kind of interested in Echoes just because it seemed like it was doing some things differently, if that's happening still, I'm not interested.
Yeah, but the thing with Echoes is it's way easier to pick up levels because there's stuff to do to get them.
Right.
Yeah, I'm kind of torn with what I'd like to see, because on the one hand, I like the idea of, like, having, like, Echoes has some of this, although I've not played it, but, you know, like, having other things to do in the world, you know, around the sort of showpiece battles, you know, being able to explore those dungeons and, yeah, that kind of stuff. But on the other hand, I really like, you know, of the sort of... the Fates dichotomy, I prefer the conquest strain of, okay, you've got your kind of fixed number of battles, and so, you know, all these skirmishes are a scarce resource, and it's up to you to manage them, you know, as well as you can. Although I think Guillaume's point is well taken, of that component of it suffers from that, have sort of that stochastic element with the leveling up. But yeah, so on the one hand, I'd like the purity of, like, okay, you know, the game roughly knows, like, how powerful your party can be, you know, as in general, and has these very sculpted kind of encounters around that. And there's a nice sort of curve that it could create. It's very deliberate. And then on the other hand, like, this idea of expanding things and being able to do more things outside of the main chapters that, you know, could like help with the world building and could help people that want to level up, but does it throw off the kind of carefully constructed design and all that kind of stuff? So yeah, it's I mean, I'm kind of torn on it, because I mean, I enjoyed Conquest, but you could argue, well, I've had that now, so maybe you're something more in a different, you know, that especially like with the the greater aesthetic kind of quality that could be achieved on Switch. It might be nice to see the world building given more kind of mm-hmm. of a focus.
I was just going to say selfishly on that, they should remove the level cap and have more post-game stuff that's higher. I'm specifically looking at Fire Emblem Heroes, where every new mission now is just level 40 in difficulty because you can't get above level 40 and they refuse to adjust the level cap, and some level 40s are harder than other level 40s, and...
Okay, some of those, like, get this character elite missions are impossible.
Oh, yeah.
Like, no, nobody's allowed to die. Well, they can shoot you for 100 damage as soon as you start the map, so...
They should, increase the level cap and make more difficult content for the players who want it.
Yeah. The one other thing I'd like to point out, and we've talked about storytelling, one of the things that the older Fire Emblems did, and I say older, I mean, like, when they started coming to the West, they told relatively nuanced stories. And when I say relatively, I mean, like, they spent a lot of time talking about different factions and different motivations, and there is world building. There are multiple states in play. You meet royalty from multiple states. They have kind of weird relationships with each other. There's political intrigue in play. I wouldn't say it's fantastic writing, but like they put the effort in. What I would like to see potentially is actually have it so I can make some decisions. And I'm not asking you to say, like, don't tell me that you'll make 3,600 decisions and at the end you'll pick green, purple, or red. I mean, like, you know, maybe not necessarily even huge decisions, but like a couple. Like, there's a good example. Ogre Battle actually is a good example because the handful of choices you make that determine like what characters are available for you to join with, because the other path you take, you end up dealing with them in a very similar battle. Ultimately, the outcome is mostly the same, but you get a slightly different interstitial stories as a play to that. It's not like a big huge plot alteration, but you know, the interstitial changes.
I would argue that Fire Emblem Fates gave you the biggest decision. Which game are you going to play?
Yeah, that's not a decision. I mean, that's like saying in Mega Man Battle Network 5, if you wanted to fight the Colonel or fight Zero, that was your decision because it's one you bought. Like, no. Like, there's more. You're right. There's more story differences in those two.
Yes.
Games.
Those games also play very differently.
By that, I mean Network 5. But inside the game, give you some degree of real choice. And fucking rein in your DLC. Holy shit.
You don't want a $45 season pass that I bought and then went through and value. I think it was worth maybe $15, the whole thing.
Don's review of the, Don's reasonably charitable when he assesses value. Like,
yes.
His review of the value of the Echoes DLC is a thing of It should be framed in like a monolith, like chiseled onto a monolith, because it's like C-, 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 D. It's like, oh wow.
There is one piece of DLC in that whole season pass worth things, and it's not even the thing he valued highly.
Yeah, the thing he thought was the best was the tie-in to their card game. So
yes,
that tells you
because
all
it gives
about
you four
that.
New units.
Fucking unbelievable. Anyway, all right, next email. That would be Greg.
Yep. Tara writes, hey RFN crew, first time emailing. With the release of Sonic Mania, are there any other platformers you'd like to see come back with new levels and older ones redesigned?
Let's keep it serious.
She knows my answers already. She watches the streams.
Guillaume, I feel like you might have an answer here.
I'm not sure. When I go back to older platformers, I kind of realize that I might just be a Mario fan in the end, or just a Kirby fan, and not all platformers were that good.
The whole idea is that you might be sprucing things up and maybe, you know, like taking out some rough edges. So think of a fixer-upper, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, well, that. The thing is, I have discovered a love of Hudson platformers, mostly Adventure Island. Not the first one. The first one is garbage. But the sequels were pretty good. So I guess I you know, I could go for that, but yeah, fat chance.
Yeah, well, I mean, remember, it's isn't like, what do you think's going to happen?
Well, you never know. You never know. Konami might just randomly resurrect another Hudson thing like they did with Bomberman. I mean,
yeah, and I guess the question is, like, that series has been on so many different platforms. Which one do you want to... Like, with Sonic, it's kind of easy to determine exactly, you know, what the golden age for that series was and what the... art style was like, and you know, they're not gonna pick like the Game Gear sprites for the remake, but in this case, like, there was Super Nintendo Super Adventure Island that looked quite good, but there was also New Adventure Island on the TG-16, and I really liked that aesthetic, like that the cartoony look that it has. I was super impressed with it when I played it for the first time on the Wii Virtual Console. And yeah, I guess that's the way I would like a remake to look. The thing is, though, I think that, you know, when I mentioned Adventure Island, there's probably a lot of people who think, like, oh yeah, dinosaurs. Bring back the dinosaurs. They were not in that game, in the TG-16 game. So, you know, like, maybe have fun with that. Like, you know, insert in Adventure Mania, you know, some of these elements from the later NES games.
The mashup kind of, yeah, it seems, given that the convoluted history of that, it actually kind of seems quite apt for something that kind of coalesces everything, you know, like in a quasi remake, quite new game kind of hybrid thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think you just kind of mix iconography of these games together that stand on there, like, oh, I remember that from blank, and like, you kind of end up creating a sort of a homunculus of that franchise, but it's fine.
Other than that, like, Hudson has a quite good looking remake of Bunk on the GameCube that would have been fun to get outside of Japan.
I tried to buy that in Japan explicitly because I thought people on the show would like it, and I could not get a copy.
Yeah. Unfortunate. So yeah, I, you know, like, yeah, stuff like that, stuff that probably that Nintendo is not making or has not been getting. Like, I'd want, I guess, platformers from a, you know, a different platforms that I've never played before.
Blinks?
No.
No.
No one wants to make the Blinks.
No.
Greg?
I'm gonna go with the softball option, Castlevania.
Castlevania, though?
Well, that's the point. You would be drawing from a bunch of the. I'm talking about the, you know, the old school linear ones here. Naturally, you know, in the vein of the first game, the third game, Super Castlevania 4, Rondo, that sort of stuff. But, you know, it seems kind of suitable to me because a lot of Castlevania games, you know, they have levels with similar themes, you know, so why not have like a sort of composite clockwork, you know, a clock tower stage that like fuses bits together from what the other clock tower stage is in an attempt to create the ultimate clock tower level that will probably make you rip your hair out. You know, it seems like that's probably about the extent, like, well, it's probably beyond the extent of anything you could actually expect from Konami to do with Castlevania at this juncture. But, you know, it seems about as ambitious a thing as you could hope for in terms of, like, you could actually, like, repurpose stuff and maybe outsource it to fans the way that, you know, they did with Sonic. And use all these games, you know, these great games of yesteryear as a sort of template for you know, making new levels or, you know, composites of old levels and stuff like that. I'm just a huge fan of those games. I mean, I like the Mel Metroid-like ones, but those old classics, that's what I started with the series on, and the difficulty, and like I said, those stage themes, it was a really cool component of Castlevania, and it had this very strong sense of place, actually contextualised the journey through the castle and all that stuff, and it would just be kind of nice to see, a bunch of different stuff from those locations from the series kind of brought together and synthesized the one common aesthetic and design, kind of approach and all that. I think it's probably about the most we could hope for the franchise at this point as well.
Hmm. Yeah. At least the Castlevania Adventure Rebirth was better looking than the Adventure Island and the WiiWare that we got.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, they went with, like, awkward 3D graphics that just looked like
pure. Ah, right, yeah. Whereas Adventure Rebirth, all those Rebirth games were M2 developed, so as you might imagine, it was pixel art. I mean, not the prettiest pixel art, that series has seen, probably, but and actually did have some original sprite work, which, when Castlevania was hale and hearty, sometimes I had a trouble discovering new sprite work.
So, Ryan?
I've been thinking about this. Is a game from 8 years ago too soon for this?
Well, it depends.
Or 9 years ago, actually? Shit, it's been a long time.
What's the game?
The time is right for Nuts and Bolts 2.
No. I don't know that you can make that game in a post-Minecraft world.
I think you can, because Minecraft is about world construction, and this is about vehicle platforming. Like, there's the vehicle construction element, but it was a platformer that revitalized 3D platformers, my interest in 3D platformers for a period of time, because it was doing such new things, because I hadn't really been doing a lot of, custom vehicle platforming, and if I needed to get higher, just throw 8 more engines on this thing.
That's fair, but you and I both know that they just make that like a Minecraft add-on pack now because that's Microsoft's money.
I don't think it's realistic, especially with what Sea of Thieves is. Yeah. But this isn't.
You're right.
What one do you expect to come back? This is what would you like to come back?
You're right.
And like, I'm trying to think of nostalgic platformers for me. And I don't really have a lot of platformer nostalgia outside of ones that never went away.
Mario will never die.
Mario will never die.
Well, I mean, Mario 2D did go away, and then it came back.
Yes, and then that never went away.
It's been a little while now, and there's nothing.
Mario Maker was
still 10 years later.
Mario Maker was 2 years ago, and Super Mario Run was less than a year ago.
Yeah, that's true. But an original kind of quest, if you like.
Super Mario Run is less than a year old.
Well,
that's an
it's
original
not new Super Mario Run, though.
No, it is. It does not have the word "new" in the title. I will give you
different
that
game altogether. The new changes everything.
I'll give you that, even though it uses the same art style,
same
soundtrack.
I wish it was
same
called New Super Mario Bros. Run, because that would have been fucking confusing.
Anyways, as far as like actual like. I'm trying to think. 2D and early. I don't like early 3D platformers. Super Mario 64 accepted, and Banjo-Tooie accepted. I don't really like PS1, Dreamcast, and N64 era platformers.
Yeah, like that's the thing. Like I've been. Sometimes I will give a classic quote unquote PlayStation 1 title a shot when it pops up on PSN, and like Pandemonium, not good.
Nope.
By Crystal.
Tomba.
Tomba? Is that your answer?
That is my answer.
Tomba done in the art style that they promoted the game in, that claymation-y
exactly
game, which you could totally do now.
Take the artists at HAL that made Kirby and the Rainbow Curse and give them Tomba.
Yeah, that'd look awesome. Mm-hmm. Like it would look better than the ads they made for that game.
Exactly. There's my answer. Tomba.
Oh, that's a good one. All right, so I have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I have a real problem. Yes. And you're going to see that problem in a second.
Okay.
Because I have a bunch of answers for this.
Oh, good. By the way, one more. Saberman Collection. Sorry,
no, those aren't platform. Those are maze games. Remember.
So your answers are what, like Mega Man, Mega Man X, Mega Man Power Transmissions, Mega Man.
Mega Man X to some degree, probably more than the rest of them are platformers because those games had a lot of fucking platforming.
What answers do you have that aren't published by Capcom?
So that's the problem. I have a lot that are published by Konami.
Ha ha.
Smart,
and
sir.
So Greg said Castlevania, and that's why I wanted to press him on which one do you want, because I very specifically want Rondo of Blood style of that game.
Yeah, like me too.
The tone and the gameplay and the music, the everything about that game that made it special. As I like Castlevania 4 a lot. Like, I've played it multiple times. But they're very different. There's something about, Super Castlevania 4 at least twice, maybe three times to completion. But, like, the sheer glee I had playing Rondo was was different and fantastic. And so, like, that to me, that was sort of the point of, like, okay, this is what I want. Guillaume actually touched another one. I really like some of the Bonk games. Like, a lot. Like, TG-16 ones, like, they're goofy and silly, and they kind of, like, speak to that 2D mascot platformer, but they're not bullshit mascots that got created because we need a mascot, so let's go have somebody make Arrow the Acrobat. Like, Bonk is kind of an amusing character, and they basically say, like, well, he hits people with this giant forehead, therefore it's called Bonk. And, like, there's something satisfying about that. Like, that character and that everything about him. So it's two right away that I can never have. So that already things are going well. I like the Klonoa games. The Klonoa 1 especially. Like, I like that game a lot. And I don't know, the last release was like the Wii game in 2008, I think. And that was a remake.
That was the remake of the original Klonoa, yeah.
They only made, you know, two real Klonoa games.
And then you had the portable kind of puzzle spin-offs on Wonder Swan and GBA.
Yeah, Empire of Dreams, I think, and the other one was like Museum something. But yeah, they only really made two true Klonoa games, Dorda Phantom Isle and Lunatea's Vale. And like, I would like to see something made in that style. Something a little closer, for lack of a better way of putting it, a little closer to home. I'd love to see Drill Dozer. And that's kind of stretching platforming, but it's in there a little bit. We haven't had any of those in, well, except for the one. And then my real pull, and again, we're playing with what is a platformer, but if it's okay, and back into the Konami minds, actually double back into the you can never have this game again, Metal Warriors. Which is developed by LucasArts and published by Konami. So that game's like locked up in a vault somewhere, never to be seen again. But that game was super fun last time I played it. And it's been a little while, but like, it wasn't a long, like, I wasn't a kid. It's tough. It's challenging. And there's just something about controlling a mech that has jetpacks against other mechs that have jetpacks that's kind of always satisfying.
You know, like, I wouldn't even ask for this Sonic Mania treatment for a lot of games. I just like them to come out on Virtual Console at last, you know, stuff like Sparkster and, you know, or Rocket Knight. I don't know. That series naming convention is kind of complicated.
Yeah, I guess Rocket Knight Adventures was on... That was Genesis first. And then there was Sparkster on Super Nintendo, but then there was also a Sparkster on Genesis. There was a different game or something?
A different game,
That started a character that should be called Sparkster.
Right.
Yeah, it's strange. There was a revival with that, wasn't there? You know, there was an XBLA PS3 game.
Yeah, there was.
As warmly received, so it kind of went in that territory. It's funny actually, because like the whole older levels redesign thing is something that the GBA remake of Supergirls and Ghosts did. In the arrange mode of that game, if you finish a level of the sort of typical Supergirls and Ghosts campaign with the bronze armor, then you go to extra level that was not in the Super Nintendo version, that was some sort of remix of elements from the other two games in the mainline Makomura series, the original and Ghouls and Ghosts. So, that had that kind of vibe going for it all the way back then, which was nice because, a lot of those GBA remakes did not have the sort of extra content on that sort of scale.
Just ports.
Yeah. So but equally, it wasn't just like literally the same as the other as their original versions either. It was kind of a remix type of concept.
All right. Cool. Well, that is going to do it for the show this week. Again, you can send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and we will address them accordingly.
But not next week.
But not next week, no. Well, sort of. Because next week, we are recording our live retroactive of Super Mario Sunshine. I almost said Super Mario Galaxy again because wishful thinking is a powerful thing. That will be on August 24th, 2017, starting at 9 p.m. Eastern. We will be live at NintendoWorldReport.com and in the Discord to discuss the last... up to this point, 3D open-ish world platforming game in the Mario series and all the awesomeness that is therein. I hope you can join us because we'll be taking questions and comments and we'll even have a few call-ins. If you can't make it on time, though, that's okay. You can post comments in the talkback thread at Nintendo World Report or you can email them to the inbox. I'm tagging them so we have them available. I'm glad to see I'm not the only one who was trying to use the GameCube controller to aim Mario spray.
So, you mean with
Splatoon.
Motion?
Yeah.
It was an adventure playing those two games alongside each other with the inverted X-axis. That was. Yeah, there was a few times where I'd actually played Sunshine for quite a while and then I was doing silly things in Splatoon and that really made me angry.
I've had a remarkable number of people openly admit to trying to use motion controls while they're playing Sunshine, which makes me feel better because I have screwed up multiple missions because of that.
It's just intuitive, isn't it? That's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, you just kind of get into the cycle, and it feels similar enough in your hand, I guess, that the brain kicks in. Because I never try to use motion controls with the PS4 controller. But I don't know. It's weird. Saran, what do you have to promote?
Okay, so you can follow me on Twitter at SarenMCN. In the coming weeks, I have some Monochrono Prologue stuff. You can go to fourcornergames.com to check out a blog post that's currently up as of time recording about what that means. To be brief, it's coming to Humble and Itch on PC and being deprecated on phones due to policy reasons and a fight that I'm sick of having with Apple and Google. And then James and I have been playing through the entirety of a game called Lady Killer in a Bind. It's not safe for work. I talked about it last year. If you are 18 plus and want to watch this, you can follow me on Twitch, which is linked in my Twitter.
You can hear me die.
I don't know. James is the one making every single decision. Which led us to some BDSM scenes. And with that, I'll let James
fuck off. you let us. You're like, you should really do this right now. You should do this.
I'm not
you
the one
totally
who made everyone suspicious of your ass. You racked up the suspicion. You would have gotten a game over on the second day if you hadn't.
I should have done that then, shouldn't I? I'm just trying to name characters bad things, okay? I'm just trying to be passive-aggressive here.
You're using the tilde question marks that you said you hated on the first episode. You've been using that in the second and third episodes.
Oh, God. Anyway, I just want to die. I want to die. Guillaume, cut all this out. Cut the whole episode out. Just play the intro music, and then, Greg, play what's our closing music.
Well, yeah, so we got a request here. This one I've had stored up for a long time. It's from Cooper. This dates back to like early 2016, so I'm sorry, Cooper, it took this long to use it, and I hope you're still listening for some bloody reason. But yeah, this request is the Dam theme from GoldenEye 007 for N64. The opening level, it was kind of... quite memorable for those of us who played it back in 1997. And the reason why I'm using it now is because a few days after this episode goes up, it will be the 20th anniversary of GoldenEye, 20 years old.
We're all old.
Yeah, we certainly are. It's kind of crazy to contemplate, but couldn't turn down that occasion. Back when I originally got it, I was like, something Bond related will come up. You know, they'll announce the new movie or who the new actor's going to be or whatever, and it didn't happen. And I thought, I'll do it for the 20th anniversary. And then the same week, we got the announcement that Craig's coming back for one
the
more.
New Bond. The new Bond is the old Bond.
Yeah. Yeah, those converged to the other.
There's no way they could pay me enough money. Oh, yes, they can. Never mind.
But, I had to use it at this point. But it is as well apt, James going through Rare Replay. This is.
Which will never be on this collection.
No, but Perfect Dark is on it. And, obviously, this is the work of some of the Rare composers who were. Did a lot of the soundtracks to those games on Rare Replay, like Grant Kirkhope and Robin Beanland. Rare does Bond stuff, basically. Great stuff. Lots of memories bound up in this, and happy to finally use it with apologies once again to Cooper.
Excellent. Well, on that, it's time to wrap the show up. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.